So the president has discussed this idea quite a few times publicly. He's also discussed it privately. You're referring to the president's idea for American citizens to potentially be deported. These would be heinous, violent criminals who have broken our nation's laws repeatedly. And these are violent repeat offenders in American streets. The president has said, if it's legal, right? If there is a legal pathway to do that, he's not sure. We are not sure if there is. It's an idea that he has simply floated and has discussed very publicly as in the effort of transparency.
Yeah. Why doesn't that transparency make me feel any better today?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Down the stairs, clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and of course on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another edition of the Bradcast. It has been far too long, Desi Doyen, since we've spoken to our friend Mark Joseph Stern, the Legal at Slate.com and longtime friend of the show. He will be joining us momentarily to help me parse this late ruling. Just moments after we signed off of yesterday's show, it came in from the right-wing corrupted activist U.S. Supreme Court regarding Donald Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to deport hundreds of migrants from Venezuela that his administration claims to be gang members, to ship them to a notorious El Salvadoran gulag without any due process. And even though the Alien Enemies Act only applies, at least as written, to aliens from enemy nations that have, according to the statute, declared war against the United States or have otherwise invaded it as part of that officially declared war. It's a confusing ruling from the court that I really, really hope that I am misunderstanding as far as not only what it could mean for these deported Venezuelan migrants, but for other migrants and what for, if I'm reading it correctly, it could mean for even citizens of the United States, like, yep, you or me or Desi Doyen.
Yep.
Anyone else listening to this show.
I hope you're wrong.
I'm sure I've got it all wrong. And he will straighten me out shortly. So, quickly, first, a few lighter topics, such as the Wall Street bloodbath that continued on Tuesday, marking the fourth straight day of brutal losses for investors since Trump declared Liberation Day at the White House by announcing huge tariffs, sanctions against virtually every nation on Earth, except for Russia. For some odd reason. I noted yesterday, as the worst sell-off since the COVID pandemic was going on, of course, that was the last time Donald Trump was in office as well, even as a number of diehard Trump supporters in the right-wing manosphere, including both media types and billionaire hedge fund types, had begun to turn against the Trump tariff regime. I mentioned that yesterday. That's good. But now it seems so are some elected Republicans, at least a few of them, at least in the U.S. Senate. But it's got to start somewhere, and Congress is the one body that can actually stop this madness immediately if they wanted to, since they are the ones who granted presidents tariff authority in the first place. They granted it, and they can take it away immediately if they want to. Well, more and more do seem to now be wanting to, at least wanting to act as if they want to. According to The Hill, cracks are growing between congressional Republicans and President Trump over his tariff policy, with some lawmakers looking to strip him of his unilateral tariff authority. 7 Republican senators now have signed on to a bill led by Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, and Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington State, that would require the president to give Congress 48 hours notice of new tariffs, make them subject to congressional approval after 60 days, and allow Congress to rescind tariffs. The legislative effort, which has emerged as a proxy fight for those against the tariffs, became a quick flashpoint on Monday as the number of co-sponsors grew, and the White House threatened to veto the bill in advance. The attempt by the White House to nip the push in the bud only hours before lawmakers returned to the Capitol has not stemmed the concern among GOP lawmakers who worried the economy could continue to tumble after Wall Street saw a third straight day in the red to open the week. Of course, that make that 4 straight days now as of Tuesday. Quote, "It's very hard to overturn a veto," said Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, who has not signed on to the bill yet, but has emerged as a leading voice against Trump's widespread tariffs. "It doesn't mean the battle isn't worth having," he said. "Win or lose, it's worth the debate." The latest effort, the Hill notes, comes after 4 Republicans, Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, and Rand Paul of Kentucky as well, voted with Democrats last week to pass a measure to undo Trump's tariffs on Canada. Trump added another layer to the tariff debate on Monday by threatening China with an additional 50% tariff if Beijing does not rescind its retaliatory 54% tariff that was revealed last week after the president's Liberation Day event, where Trump made clear that tariffs against China would be 54%. So now adding another 50% on top of that, now we're at 104% tariff. That, of course, would be madness, not only for the markets, but for the inflationary effect on damn near everything. Look around. Pick something up around your house. Take notice of how much of it was actually made in China. Some of the worries are also shared in the House, as The Hill reports. Congressman Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, plans to introduce companion legislation in the lower chamber to rein in the president's tariff authority. He said on Sunday, this was just after 2 days of the market tanking, he said, quote, "I think if we get 60 votes in the Senate, it will put pressure on the House to look at this. And if we continue to see the stock market go a certain direction," said Bacon, "or if we see inflation or unemployment shift in a bad way, I think then this bill becomes a very viable bill." So he said that on Sunday. That was after just 2 days of the market tanking. Now we're at 4 days in a row of that happening. Bacon recognized that the bill will not be brought up immediately or in the coming weeks, quote, "but this will be in the queue that we can use," he said. Now, there are others in both the House and Senate who seem either interested in these measures or otherwise suggesting that they are very wobbly on this whole tariff deal that Trump has created, this mess that he has created for the U.S. and for the world economy. Now, to be clear, it's easy for House Speaker Mike Johnson to use procedural means to ensure that such a measure is never allowed to come up for a vote, as he's able to block even something called a discharge petition if he wants to, where a majority of House members sign on to insist on a vote on any particular bill. And as Rand Paul notes, it's difficult to overcome a veto of the president. It requires a 2/3 vote in each chamber, but that does not mean that pressure should not be brought to bear against lawmakers anyway. As Josh Marshall correctly notes at Talking Points Memo today, recognizing that this issue isn't fully ripe yet, he says, quote, "it's telling that there are already 7 Republican senators on the bill before the tariffs even go into effect. This bill now becomes the focus of everything on this issue," he says. Republicans in Congress, he notes, could bring this catastrophic stupidity to a halt at any moment. And the public needs to know that, he argues. They're the target here, not Trump. They face re-election. He doesn't. The pressure will only increase, he argues. Simply passing the law and getting it vetoed would be a big and critical step forward because it would let people know that this is all in Congress's hands. It's a big deal, even if it has to go, even if it has a way to go. If and when this actually happens, it will not only be good policy because presidents can't be given this carte blanche authority, but also a crushing defeat for Trump's presidency. And the immiseration could get there sooner than people think. So, you know, sort of stick a pin in that particular effort. And remember that it's your member of Congress and your senator that could end this this madness tomorrow if they actually wanted to.
And we have seen in some circumstances that strong public pressure has caused Republicans to change their tune. And also the Trump administration has made some changes, too, based on public pressure.
And there hasn't even been that much pressure yet. And yet seven Republicans in the U.S. Senate are already trying to pass a bill to take away Trump's tariffing authority, which he is obviously abusing to the detriment of just about everyone in the world, except for Russia. And one more before we get to Mark, just in from AP over the past hour. A federal judge ordered the White House on Tuesday to restore the Associated Press's full access to cover presidential events, ruling on a case that touched at the heart of the First Amendment and affirming that the government cannot punish the news organization for the content of its speech. You'll recall that AP was barred from certain press events in the White House and on Air Force One because the international news outlet noted in its style guide that it would continue to refer to the Gulf of Mexico by its internationally known name, even while recognizing that Donald Trump had unilaterally renamed it the Gulf of America in the United States via executive order, amounting to a punishment against the AP for its exercise of free speech, at least according to their lawsuit and according to the judge on Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Trevor McFadden, an appointee of Donald Trump. That seems important.
Yeah.
Ruled that the government can't retaliate against the AP's decision not to follow the president's executive order to rename the Gulf of Mexico. Quote, under the First Amendment, McFadden wrote, if the government opens its doors to some journalists, be it to the Oval Office, the East Room, or elsewhere, it cannot then shut those doors to other journalists because of their viewpoints. The Constitution, he said, requires no less.
It's called viewpoint discrimination.
The AP had asked Judge McFadden to rule that Trump had violated AP's constitutional right to free speech by taking the action because he disagreed with the words that its journalists use. It was unclear how quickly the White House would move to put McFadden's ruling into effect. The government has a week to respond. But that seems to be good news. Of course, it should surprise no one if the administration appeals that ruling all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where it clearly has a few friends who are willing to pretend that they give a damn about the literal text of rights that are enumerated by the Constitution and the laws adopted by Congress. But as the past 24 hours have reminded us, they do not appear to give a damn in reality about any of that. At least if I'm reading an order issued by the court late last night correctly. The great Mark Joseph Cern, who is much better at reading such orders, joins us next to talk me off the ledge. Also, Desi Doyen is here with our latest Green News Report a bit later.
Yes.
I'm Brad Friedman, and for now anyway, this is still the Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, we spent some time on yesterday's program explaining the tragic, horrific, really, story of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. He's the El Salvador-born Maryland resident, married to a U.S. citizen and father of their five-year-old autistic son. Abrego Garcia was, despite being granted protection from deportation by an immigration judge back in 2019 after fleeing persecution from gangs in his home country, he was recently snatched out of an IKEA parking lot in front of his son by ICE and eventually sent to a gulag back in his home country of El Salvador, where, as a U.S. District Court judge who ordered the U.S. government last week to retrieve him noted in her order, he is now facing potential violence from the very persecutors that he had fled years ago. And while that story is bad enough, it's made far worse by the fact that Trump's Justice Department has admitted, or at least claimed, that his deportation was actually a mistake. But the Trump administration has also absurdly told the court that they can no longer get him back now that he's in El Salvador. There's nothing they can do. Sorry, not sorry. The U.S. district judge was not buying it and ordered the government to do everything within their power to get him out of that prison in El Salvador and back to the U.S. no later than Monday at 11:59 p.m. The Trump administration thereafter quickly took that order to the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, seeking an emergency stay on the order, which Chief Justice John Roberts quickly granted, at least temporarily, on Monday. Abrego Garcia was on one of three planes loaded with migrants sent to El Salvador on March 15. The other two planes are said to have contained Venezuelan migrants deported after Trump's invocation of the Wartime Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The deportations were carried out, apparently, after a different U.S. District Court judge in D.C., James Boasberg, had ordered that the court be notified before any deportations happened under the AEA and that any planes set for Venezuela or in the air already during his emergency hearing must be turned around and brought back immediately to the U.S. The Trump administration appears to have ignored the judge's order and shipped the men off to the gulag in El Salvador anyway, with no due process whatsoever, despite claims that at least some of them are not members of a violent Venezuelan gang, as the U.S. government had claimed. The men were not allowed to make their case, and it has since become clear that at least one or more had nothing to do with the Tren de Aragua gang that the administration claims they are all members of. The Alien Enemies Act is only supposed to be used during wartime, as it applies only to a, quote, foreign nation that has, quote, declared war against the U.S. or has mounted, quote, an invasion or predatory incursion. The Trump administration claims that the Tren de Aragua gang is invading the U.S. and thus they are allowed to detain or deport members as they see fit, apparently, without even the barest minimum due process. Judge Boasberg disagreed. The Trump administration marched back to their friends at the Supreme Court for another emergency intervention thereafter, and no sooner did we get off the air yesterday than, well, they received that intervention in a 5-4 ruling on the emergency so-called shadow docket, where cases are not fully briefed before SCOTUS makes what are supposed to be only emergency, usually temporary, rulings. In recent years, however, the court has made more and more use of that shadow docket to make larger and larger decisions, often without justices even signing their names to their opinions. On Monday night, in a wildly confusing, at least to a layman like me, and divided 5-4 ruling, the court allowed the Trump administration to use that 18th century wartime law to deport those Venezuelan migrants who had already been deported, but said that In the future, if I understand it, the government must allow time for a court hearing before detainees are removed from the U.S. Moreover, the men on the court ruled in that 5-4 ruling, in opposition to the women of the court, that any such court cases must be brought on an individual basis by each migrant in the jurisdiction where they are being held. For example, in the right-wing federal courts of Texas or Louisiana, not in the D.C. federal court, where these migrants brought their challenge before Judge Boasberg as a class action suit. Quote, "We, as a nation and a court of law, should be better than this," wrote Justice Sonia Sotomayor in her blistering dissent on behalf of the court's minority female justices, decrying yet another hastily made ruling from the so-called shadow docket without benefit of full briefs and oral argument, and citing several of the contradictions and completely unanswered questions in the majority's four-paragraph unsigned opinion. Quote, "Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson," Slate's Mark Joseph Stern notes, "was equally blunt in a separate dissent, drawing a comparison between Monday's decision and the court's notorious ruling in favor of Japanese internment in 1944's notorious Korematsu v. U.S. case." That was, by the way, the last time the Alien Enemies Act was invoked by a president, and as pretty much everyone now agrees, he did so shamefully. Quote, "At least when the court went off base in the past, it left a record so posterity could see how it went wrong," Justice Jackson wrote, castigating her colleagues for smuggling through their dirty work on the shadow docket, observed Stern. "With more and more of our significant rulings taking place in the shadows of our emergency docket," wrote the justice, "today's court leaves less and less of a trace. But make no mistake," she said, "we are just as wrong now as we have been in the past with similarly devastating consequences. It just seems we are now less willing to face it." Joining us now is the great Mark Joseph Stern, who covers the law, the court system, the U.S. Supreme Court, election law, LGBTQ issues, and so much more, as a senior writer at Slate.com, and who can hopefully help me understand if I got my explanation of Tuesday night's stunning, if not surprising, ruling even close to correct. It has been too long, but welcome back to the broadcast, Mark Joseph Stern.
Thank you so much for having me. Always happy to be here.
Good to have you here. And boy, do I need help on this one. Before we get into what I see as the huge matters of what the court majority did not speak to in its ruling and what it means for Donald Trump and his corrupted Supreme Court moving forward after a decision that you write, quote, "couldn't be more ominous," did I get the basics of this very confusing ruling generally correct first?
I would say that you got it correct on the whole. There are some details that we can fill in.
Good.
But basically, you got this this very strange and, in my view, unfortunate decision right. And it's going to, I would just add, cause a lot of confusion and chaos and uncertainty in the lower courts and for these migrants who the administration is trying to disappear to El Salvador.
Well, I bet, since it caused a great deal of confusion here, just trying to read through it and understand it. The one piece of good news seems to be that all of the justices agreed that migrants set to be deported under the Alien Enemies Act must at least be notified in advance and given a legitimate chance to challenge that deportation in court, but that they can't do it as a group and they can't do it in the friendlier courts in D.C., unless that's where they're being detained. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, that is the problem with the decision. That is the bad part of the decision. And it's really bad because, you know, as you indicated, these migrants had brought their suit as a class. It was a class action in federal court in D.C., arguing that the entire program of deportation here was unlawful, that the invocation of the Alien Enemies Act was illegal, that their denial of due process was illegal, that the scheme was arbitrary and capricious. And Judge Boasberg, the district court judge, had issued this very broad temporary restraining order against essentially the entire program. And what the Supreme Court did was lift that restraining order and essentially dissolve the class action and say that the individual plaintiffs each have to instead file habeas petitions, which we can talk about, but they're narrower lawsuits in the district where they're being confined, which is, for most of them, Texas. And that is going to be difficult. It's very unlikely that they can do so in a group, let alone as an entire class. Mm-hmm. Habeas petitions usually are filed one by one. And they're going to have to do so before much more hostile judges. The federal courts in Texas are filled with Trump appointees, and every case gets appealed to the notorious Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
Right.
Yes, that's the problem.
But is it at least good news that they're saying that the justices are saying before anyone is shipped out, at least they have some sort of due process?
That is good. It's certainly better than if the justices hadn't said that. It was a unanimous point of agreement on the court, and it rebukes one of the Trump administration's arguments that it has made on and off throughout this litigation, which is the idea that the Alien Enemies Act effectively overrides the due process clause of the Constitution. The Trump administration had argued that it could declare that these people are terrorists or gang members or alien soldiers and send them on a plane off to a prison in El Salvador. I think Gulag is really, frankly, an accurate description of it, and not afford them any objection, any opportunity to object in a court or to get any kind of judicial relief. The Supreme Court did say no to that sweeping argument. The Supreme Court said quite clearly that every individual targeted under this law or any law is still a person in the United States who deserves and receives due process freedoms. And so, at least in theory, the government will no longer be able to ship these people off in the dead of night before they even have a chance to get to federal court to object.
That said, and I don't know if you heard this this clip, this is from Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, on Tuesday. Maybe you can help decode this comment from her.
The justices also said that deportees are entitled to due process. Does the administration agree with that?
That's not quite true, Gabe. They said that they are entitled to a habeas petition, and we are going to continue to comply with the law, and we are wholly confident that every single person that has been deported under the Alien Enemies Act, every person that will continue to be deported under the Alien Enemies Act, qualifies for that deportation.
So never mind what she's saying about who qualifies and who doesn't. I'm trying to get at her yes to habeas, but not to due process.
Let me just read from the majority opinion last night.
Okay.
Quote, "It is well established that the Fifth Amendment entitles aliens to due process of law in the context of removal proceedings. So the detainees are entitled to notice and opportunity to be heard." That is straight from the opinion. That is due process. She is wrong. She is, I guess, correct that they have to raise these due process complaints through a habeas petition, but that doesn't mean that they don't get due process. She's just harping on the specific form that the court said this complaint has to take, which is just meaningless. I mean, it's argle bargle.
That's what I thought, but I'm glad you could confirm that. All right, then there's the matter of what the court left out of their ruling. For a start, great, I guess, that future detainees, you know, to be deported under AEA will have a right to challenge that in some fashion if they can find an attorney and if they can do so before they are shipped out. But what of that right for the dozens of men who are already deported to this gulag in El Salvador? Will they have access to any due process at all? And since the government in the Abrego Garcia case has absurdly said that, oh, they can't get him back from El Salvador now that he's there, does that mean that these Venezuelans, these two plane loads full at least, are now stuck in El Salvador forever?
So you are asking the right question, which is essentially, if the government can force these plaintiffs to file habeas petitions in the district where they are being held, and hundreds of them are being held in the country of El Salvador, what is the district where they should file?
Right.
I do not have an answer for you. And frankly, the majority doesn't seem to have contemplated this question, which is really bizarre because the Abrego Garcia case is at the court right now. Chief Justice Roberts issued a temporary administrative stay, but the full court is due to issue a decision in that at some point soon. So the court must know that this is an issue that, you know, in the case of Abrego Garcia, we have a person who was legally protected against deportation to El Salvador, but was sent there anyway based on what the government acknowledges to be an administrative administrative error. Right. So what can they do once they're in the gulag? Well, the Trump administration, through the Justice Department, argues that the answer is nothing. The Trump administration told the Supreme Court that in its view, individuals, once they have been sent to the prison in El Salvador, have had their constitutional rights permanently extinguished, that they have no right to due process or any other rights, procedural or substantive, and further, that federal courts have no jurisdiction to order any kind of relief to help them. So according to the government, once a person has been sent to the gulag, they can do absolutely nothing to get out, and federal courts don't even have the power to try. I hope that the Supreme Court does not agree with that, but that is the position that the government has taken. And if that is the case, then these hundreds of people who've already been sent to the gulag simply have no recourse to get out and have to rot away there indefinitely.
Which is terrifying, Mark.
Terrifying.
Because, as and let me go back to the ruling here, Justice Sotomayor in her dissent, like I said, all of the women went along, though you note that Republican appointed Justice Amy Coney Barrett did not sign on to this part for some reason. But Sotomayor writes, quote, "The government's conduct in this litigation poses an extraordinary threat to the rule of law. Its position is that United States citizens could be taken off the streets, forced onto planes, confined to foreign prisons with no opportunity for redress if judicial review is denied, even unlawfully, as was the case here, before removal. History," she yes. writes, "is no stranger to such lawless regimes, but this nation's system of laws is designed to prevent, not enable, their rise." Well, apparently, Mark, that means you or me can be scooped off the street, sent accidentally to a gulag in El Salvador or anywhere else, and then all of our rights are lost forever, according to the Supreme Court?
That is what the government argued. The Supreme Court seems to have put one layer of protection between us and that fate, which is due process. And this is, again, an important aspect of the majority's decision, though in my view, not nearly enough to make up for all of the bad in it. So the majority does say you get notice in a hearing, you get due process if you're targeted for deportation. And so that means in theory that a citizen scooped up off the street would have an opportunity to object and to secure release. And by the way, something like 1 to 1.5% of individuals detained by ICE every year are actually American citizens. The burden falls disproportionately on tribal citizens and Puerto Rican people on the mainland due to racial profiling and other kinds of stereotyping. So this is not a far off hypothetical.
Right.
This is an issue that Judge Patricia Millett flagged on the D.C. Court of Appeals, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And I think that the court tried to respond to it. But as Justice Sotomayor is saying here, you know, this is not a government that cares at all about civil liberties. This is a government that is making the most sweeping and startling arguments against freedom that anyone could really imagine. And so I think her broader sort of meta point here is, why are we letting the government cut the line, granting them this very, very early emergency relief with no oral argument, with little briefing, all on the shadow docket, mm-hmm. when they are coming to us with unclean hands, having defied the lower courts in this order and treated yep. them with utmost contempt, yep. and now coming to us with an argument that wouldn't be out of place in Nazi Germany?
Well, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Apparently, I mean, that's what they're doing here. And you know, if anything, the Abrego Garcia case shows us that, oh, if they take you, Mark Joseph Stern, or me, sweep us off the street and accidentally or mistakenly, I think was the word, mistakenly send us off to one of these gulags, even the Supreme Court saying that there must be some sort of habeas petition allowed if, oops, we accidentally did not allow him to do that. Too bad. Once he's gone. I mean, that's how I read this.
Once he's gone, there's nothing to be done. You know, if you don't get a favorable decision in that habeas hearing, if you can't prove you're a citizen or you're innocent and you get shipped off to El Salvador, according to the government, too bad, you're stuck there forever. And that is the question we're now waiting on the Supreme Court to resolve.
You know, I'm disappointed that I seem to understand this ruling much better than I thought I did. I wish I had gotten it wrong. Did the court majority, Mark, speak to the matter of how Trump is even allowed to invoke this law in the first place, which sort of seems to be the starting question, given that Venezuela has not, you know, quote, declared war on the U.S. Isn't that a requirement for using this law in the first place, according to the very clear, specific, originalist text of the rarely invoked 1798 law?
It sure is. I mean, this is a law that was last used to detain and deport Nazi saboteurs who snuck into the United States during World War II. And here we are in 2025. Watching the president attempt to use it against innocent people, right? We know that at least 75% of the people targeted under this law so far and sent to El Salvador had no criminal record. This is a totally inapposite statute to deploy in this context. But, you know, the court, because it said, oh, we're only talking about habeas, we're only talking about where these cases have to be brought, it did not address the merits of the case. It did not give any hint as to how it will rule on the merits. So that is still an outstanding question that the lower courts are going to have to continue to wrestle with. And my fear is that these hacky MAGA judges in Texas and on the Fifth Circuit are going to answer it incorrectly because they're corrupted and they're super MAGA. And so that is going to set back this litigation and this relief by a very long time. And I fear going to give the government an opportunity to say, oh, your appeal was denied, your petition was denied, we're putting you on a plane, and by the time you have a chance to object, you'll be in El Salvador.
And even if, in a best-case scenario somewhere down the road, that they say, oh, yeah, no, you can't use the Alien Enemies Act here because there is no declared war, which, as you suggest, is seeming less and less
obviously
likely.
Obviously true, but that is what it should say.
Right. But even if they do say that eventually, well, we will have shipped out all of these people, and as we've learned elsewhere in this very same case, too bad. They're gone. Nothing we could do about it. So so it seems that Trump can still just keep using this as he wishes, as long as he allows some form of redress, some sort of due process. He can keep continue with his invocation of the Alien Enemies Act for a country that has not declared war against us.
I mean, that is the situation as you and I sit here and talk. That is unfortunately where the Supreme Court has left him.
And doesn't this make a joke, as if we needed more proof, but a joke out of this notion that these activist judges on the high court are actually conservative textualists who only look at the actual words of the Constitution or the statute adopted by Congress? That's crazy, right? They're not doing that. They're not doing anything close to it.
They're not doing law, is how I fear I would have to put it. It doesn't feel like any recognizable kind of law. The work product that they're putting out, the opinion, does not read like a legal opinion. It reads like an effort to give the Trump administration a victory in this case, to give them something that they can brag about on TV and social media, that the Justice Department will use to claim it is vindicated in its ongoing spat with Judge Boasberg, and that kind of occludes the reality that eventually the administration is probably going to lose, or should lose, on the merits of these cases. You know, why five male justices decided to give this totally unearned victory and intervention so early on is a topic for another conversation, but it really feels like this was a political decision that is the last signal I would want the Supreme Court to be sending at this moment.
You mentioned previously that they allowed this decision, this victory, mostly for the Trump administration, despite the fact that the DOJ, the administration, essentially thumbed its nose repeatedly against the U.S. District Judge, James Boasberg, when they failed to follow his orders to turn the planes around, failed to even inform the judge when the planes left. They wouldn't tell him, you know, how many people were on it, et cetera. Trump called for Boasberg to be impeached, but that was as if it didn't even happen. Correct? I mean, there was no reference to the way that Trump, the DOJ, was carrying out this case? to date?
No, nothing. No acknowledgement that the Justice Department comes to the Supreme Court here with unclean hands. It was left to Justice Sotomayor to point that out and to explain this horrible history. And, you know, that's why I just think John Roberts, talk is cheap, John. You know, he put out this statement a few weeks ago saying, oh, it's wrong to call for impeachment of a judge if you disagree with them. You know, people said, oh, what a great victory for Roberts the institutionalist. He's upholding the rule of law. Who cares when you're going to vote the way Trump wants you to in the end? That statement is worse than meaningless.
Yep.
In light of Roberts' vote in this case, because he is now sending the victory. The Chief Justice is sending the message that, again, the Trump administration deserved this victory and this vindication. And that is going to empower the Justice Department to continue acting in this snide and contemptuous way in many, many other cases.
Yeah, and it was so tepid. And everybody was like, oh, boy, he really pushed back on the Trump administration. Please. He did not. It was at best a slap on the wrist, and apparently one that he doesn't even care about now. So, Mark, the class action suit that had been filed before Boasberg in D.C. has, I guess, necessarily now been ended with the with the court's ruling.
It's pretty much gone.
But does the judge still get to consider sanctions against the DOJ for their refusal to follow the court's orders, the very specific and simple orders? Because if not, if he can't at least bring forward that part of the case still, it seems like we are, well, already in a whole nother and very dark era.
The Justice Department argues that Judge Boasberg has lost his ability to impose sanctions because of the Supreme Court's actions. However, the Justice Department is wrong, as is so often the case these days. Mm-hmm. Judge Boasberg has inherent powers to issue various sanctions, including contempt of court, as a judge, and he also has power under federal law to attempt to carry out those orders. He can, even when the merits have been taken away, continue to investigate how the Justice Department behaved in this case and issue sanctions, most likely fines, against the Trump officials and Justice Department lawyers who defied him. And I think he should, and I think there's a very good chance that he will.
I think he's got to. Otherwise, yes. I mean, it's
especially
over.
Now, right?
Yeah.
Like now more than ever, he's got to.
You conclude. Two more questions for you, Mark. You conclude your piece by writing that John Roberts' decision to bail Trump out is a deeply ominous sign that the Chief Justice wants to rein in lower courts, standing in the way of the MAGA agenda. If he does, it won't just be Venezuelan migrants who pay the price. I guess I think I can guess to what you're getting at there, but let me let you explain. What does that mean, Mark?
What it means is that this is far from the only emergency application at the court. The Trump Justice Department has a bunch of other cases pending, including one that was decided on Tuesday, late morning, that cleared the way for the administration to fire 16,000 probationary and federal employees, a mass purge of the civil service that is very likely illegal. I am worried that that is, again, a sign of a trend. You know, just last week on Friday, the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to unlawfully cancel $65 million in education funding to public schools and universities. I am worried that the court is just going to start rubber stamping these Trump requests for emergency relief and refuse to consider the extraordinary and immense harms that will be inflicted on the American people by doing so. That five men and sometimes Justice Barrett have just decided, you know, the real problem here isn't Trump and his lawless crusade. The real problem is district court judges standing in his way. And if that is the approach that the Supreme Court is taking, if they really do think that the real problem is judges and not the Trump administration's unprecedented assault on the rule of law, then again, we are all in grave danger. It is not just Venezuelan migrants.
And you have preempted what I was going, my final question on that, by citing that 16,000 probationary federal employees who were ordered returned to their jobs. Supreme Court said nope. And that's the third ruling on behalf of the in favor of the Trump administration over the past 2 days.
Yeah.
It seems to me that everyone was sort of waiting for, oh, no, what happens when the court decides something the Trump administration doesn't like? Then, you know, will they do it? We'll have a standoff. It'll be a constitutional crisis. Seems to me like the court is doing everything they can to avoid such constitutional crisis by simply giving the Trump administration damn near everything it wants, which
the court is standing down from its obligation. It's not meeting the moment. And look, I hope that we'll be talking again soon and we'll say, oh, we called it wrong. It looks like John Roberts really does have a little bit of spine left. But that is not what it looks like from this vantage point. And again, you know, we've talked a lot about how the Supreme Court won't save us. The federal courts won't save us, right? We have to save ourselves. Mm-hmm. And yet there are many instances in which the federal judiciary is the one thing standing between us and oblivion. And if the Supreme Court won't just step away and let federal judges in the lower courts do their job, then I fear, I don't want to say all is lost, but I fear we're all going to have to fight a lot harder to preserve democracy.
I fear you're right as well. And I hope that we do talk soon and say we got this all wrong, because right now, at least on this day, it's sure as hell starting to seem like John Roberts and the right wing majority in the court appear pretty much fully in the bag at this point for Trump's authoritarian takeover of the constitutional order. Mark Joseph Stern, you can find his work, at least until he's scooped off the streets and sent to a gulag in El Salvador, at Slate.com. You can also, and you should, follow him on the Blue Skies at MJSDC. Mark Joseph Stern of Slate.com. Always great speaking with you, my friend. Good luck to us all. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
You bet. All right, well...
Wow. I mean, I was really, really, really hoping he was going to tell you you were wrong.
Yeah, no, that's why I was when I read the opinion when it came in last night, I was really thinking, well, I must be misunderstanding this. I must have gotten this wrong. And, you know, and I read a lot of people who were writing about it, and I was really hoping that he was going to tell me otherwise. But then when you look at perhaps I should have known the headline over at Slate.com on his article, the Supreme Court's new 5-4 bailout for Trump couldn't be more ominous.
Yeah.
That said, I thought it'd be ominous for, immigrants, gang members from Venezuela, not necessarily for you or me or Mark Joseph Stern, but...
Well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of how authoritarian governments have worked in history.
But in this case, yeah, the fact that the Supreme Court itself, it's one thing, you know, sweeping people off the streets. It's yet another thing to learn that there is no, apparently, Supreme Court there that is willing to stand up for the Constitution, for constitutional rights, for the rule of law. On any of these things where, yes, as Mark noted, many people might have been hoping the courts will save us. It doesn't look like they're going to if these opinions, these rulings over the past 24 to 48 hours, all in favor of Donald Trump and what appear on paper to be absurd arguments...
Blatantly unconstitutional arguments.
Unconstitutional, unlawful. I mean, just according to the plain text of the statute in the alien enemies case, for example. And yet the Supreme Court has found a way to come around and say, yeah, we're cool with that. So, yeah, seems to be a very disturbing development that. Again, I hope I got wrong. I hope Mark got wrong. I hope we all got wrong and that we'll be proven wrong soon enough by the Supreme Court, which will show some spine and some backbone and will say enough to the fascistic rise of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And but hopefully, don't hold your breath.
Yeah, but I hope public pressure will help. So people getting out and speaking up about that hopefully will make a difference there.
I know
somehow.
It won't hurt. I know it won't hurt.
That's true.
All right. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with more excellent news in Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report. Always yeah.
Always
sunny block of, yes. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. right now as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via brandblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. I like the stop the world part there.
Yes, please.
Unfortunately, we can't stop the world even as it melts around us, as discussed in our latest Green News Report.
We've never got this much rain at one time.
Millions of Americans reeling from widespread damage of relentless extreme storms. Trump's trade war increasing the cost of reconstruction after disasters. Plus, Senate Republicans push to strip California of its clean air car standards.
All of that madness and more straight ahead from BrandBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Researchers say flood events like this are growing more severe amid the climate crisis.
Did NBC News call it a climate crisis?
Yes.
Not that it's too late or anything. Thanks, NBC. This is your Green News Report.
This is going to be a slow motion disaster.
Not that slow, Al.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, you warned us last week, but sure enough, relentless storms across the nation over the weekend.
Yes, millions of Americans across the U.S. Midwest and South are still reeling from widespread damage after a relentless days-long wave of destructive storms unleashed deadly floods and tornadoes, causing the deaths of at least 21 people as we go to air. In Arkansas, the floods ripped apart a railroad bridge, derailing a train, but there were no injuries there. In Kentucky, entire communities have been cut off after flooding and mudslides closed hundreds of roads. Roads closed due to weather disasters puts into perspective climate protests that temporarily closed down roads to demand government action. Officials warn that extensive river flooding is the next phase of the disaster. Numerous studies have found man-made climate change is intensifying extreme rainfall in the U.S., because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, and near-record warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico provided moisture and heat energy. But recovery and repair from these and other mounting climate-fueled disasters in the U.S. will now cost much more due to Donald Trump's new global trade war. Trump's import tax is spiking the price of construction materials needed to rebuild, harming damaged communities and families devastated by extreme weather. The Atlantic's Derek Thompson explains here on CNBC.
He slaps a 25% tariff on Canada, which we import our lumber from, and a 25% tariff on Mexico that we get drywall gypsum from, thus immediately raising two of the most important inputs for housing by 25%.
Worse, as tornadoes and flooding were striking across the U.S., FEMA announced its plans to dismantle a program called Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities.
Perfect.
Calling it, quote, wasteful, according to an internal memo obtained by Grist. The initiative had been delivering billions of dollars in climate adaptation projects to proactively help communities and states prepare for future extreme weather disasters before they happen. Now, all applications from 2020 forward will be canceled.
Well, don't worry about it, because the Trump administration has already said they're doing away with FEMA entirely. So we don't need to worry about any FEMA programs.
In a bid to increase logging, the Trump administration late last week issued a new declaration of emergency to roll back environmental safeguards on more than half of the public's national forests. The new order also blocks states, tribes, and communities from challenging logging proposals before they are finalized.
Well, see, who needs drywall? They can all build log cabins now.
The Trump administration's spending cuts have forced the National Weather Service to stop providing foreign language translations of its products after the contract for translation services lapsed and was not renewed. Experts say the halt puts non-English speakers at risk of missing potentially life-saving warnings about extreme weather. Federal cuts have also halted repairs to two of America's most iconic hiking trails, the Appalachian Trail in the east and the Pacific Crest Trail in the west, that had sustained damage from wildfires and intense storms. The nonprofit groups that manage the trails told the AP federal cuts threaten the trail's very existence. Finally, in politics, the U.S. Senate Parliamentarian and the Government Accountability Office have both ruled that Senate Republicans do not have the authority to use a legislative maneuver called the Congressional Review Act to repeal California's special waiver under the Clean Air Act to set its own vehicle emissions standards. That was an EPA waiver established years ago to help tackle the state's notorious air pollution.
Why do I think there's a second part of this story coming?
Well, the Republican-controlled Senate has already deployed the regulation-killing Congressional Review Act to overturn other Biden-era pollution and climate rules. Despite those adverse rulings, Senate Republicans appear intent on pushing ahead to revoke California's waiver anyway.
They're just going to ignore the parliamentarian and the GAO.
Yep.
That sounds like my Republicans. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website. It's greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
They're going to do what they want to anyway because they really, really, really cannot stand the idea that there will be any competition for the fossil fuel industry's products that you might find in, you know, a clean air car like an electric vehicle. I mean, they just really want to make pollution as horrible as possible.
And their fossil fuel friends as rich as possible,
well,
of course,
yeah.
Because then they give that money to them and helps them stay in office and the cycle continues. Boy, I feel like in many ways I should apologize for today's show. I'm suddenly feeling very Canadian, like it's my fault that all the news is so grim. I am sorry about that. But, you know, we don't make the news. We just report it.
Yep. This is what's happening. It is what it is.
And yet, I'm still sorry. In any event, thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer.
Yep.
Thanks to my guest today, the great Mark Joseph Stern of Slate, and to all of you. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We always appreciate it. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free. Or if you just want to relive the thrills all over again at bradblog.com, that is free thanks to those of you kind enough to hit a donate button when you stop by Bradblog, or those folks who go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us out, to help us stay on your public airwaves with a one-time donation of any amount you can afford, or even better, a monthly subscription of any amount you can afford. It is all greatly appreciated. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. You'll find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at The Brad Blog, and you'll find Desi at
Green News Report.
Thank you.
Come by and say hi.
Thank you very much. That's it. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.